Welcome to Sunstone Session 171, Parody Never Faileth, the Role of Humor, Satire, and Kitsch in the Mormon Culture. My name is Laura Compton. I'll be chairing this session. I'll be sharing it with you as well. We have some fun stuff. We are going to sing, accompanied by our multi-talented and invisible, he has long fingers, Alan Eastman. He's going to accompany us while we are led by Kim McCall in the tune To Let Us All Press On. And actually the words To Let Us All Press On as well, but they're different words. If you do not have a blue sheet of paper with words printed on one side, you will need it to sing this song. If you sing the song, the words you're used to in the hymn book, you'll be singing your own tune. There is blue paper. We've got some extras here. There's some up on the front of the stage. Save it. Don't make it into an airplane until after the closing hymn, because the closing hymn is on the back side. After we sing our Sunstone style, energetic, exuberant, Let Us All Press On hymn parody, we will have an invocation by Wendy DeMondante. Alan and Kim.
I've been looking over these words. Not only are they truer than the chorus, you know, we're singing Let Us All Press On, and there's all this extra stuff in the bass, in the chorus. As far as I can tell, if you look at the second line of the chorus, and you're singing the melody, you're going to be happier singing the italicized line that looks like it's the bass line. Try it and see if it works. If I'm wrong, shoot me. Okay. We have one verse.
To be here this evening at Weber State. We're grateful to be here as the Sunstone community. We're thankful for the organization that makes this symposium possible. We're thankful for the music people tonight and what they've contributed. And we're thankful for those who have agreed to be part of this panel. Please help our minds be open. May we receive some new ideas and contribute some as well to this dialogue. And these things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Okay, now, you all know the rules. Turn off your cell phones, turn off your pagers, anything that makes noise that's going to interrupt us. You got lots of time to do it while I tell you some wonderful things that are going on upstairs. If you have not seen it already, there is a beehive balloon sculpture. If you haven't found it yet, you have not been to the Benchmark Books book room. It is in Ballroom C, and Sunstone earns a percentage of everything that's sold. So take the opportunity to go up and take a look. Come back tomorrow. I think it's probably closed for the evening, so come back tomorrow. It'll be fun. There is an art exhibit. If you aren't getting enough of your Mormon artifacts, come on in. There's lots of space over on my right. Make sure to check out. There's some great pictures of some crochets and some crochet doilies and some quilts and some stories that the Exponent 2 people have put together for us. It's on the kind of bulletin divider board as you go between the registration table and the staircase there. Also, don't miss out. Now, I know I told you about the beehive, and I'm sure you have all seen the Angel Moroni. Get your picture taken there. It's lots of fun. There is, if you're not sure which session to go to, you have a few minutes while you're waiting for somebody, there is a Golden Plates puzzle out on the puzzle table right next to some giveaway tapes. I think there's still a few cassette tapes left from previous sessions. There are some real treasures back there. I dug through a bunch. We still have one or two working tape recorders in our house, so I grabbed some. You'll have to go fast because I'm going to go look again. Make sure, if you've parked tonight, if you're parked over in this lot A2, you're in a good space. If you're not parked there, you might want to take the opportunity to move your car. Also, on Saturday, when you come back on Saturday, we can park over here in lot A10. It's a little bit closer. That's where the handicap parking is right now. So if you've got a handicap card, you can park there. If you don't, you need to park over there tonight and tomorrow. Starbucks, for those of you who need a hit, is the art building. Just south of the Student Union, they have a little sandwich sign right out there, and you'll enjoy it. Now, if you are wondering where I got this beautiful shirt, there, it's new this year. It's also being sold at the registration table. There are some other shirts there, too. There's a great Christmas tree gift. We have a matching fund of $6,600 has been donated. Our goal is to get that matched. We're a little bit more than halfway there. If you guys want to donate some money, it will be doubled if you donate here. And anyone who donates while you're here at the symposium is eligible to receive a free pint from Dolce Gelato. But you just have to do it this weekend. It's in Salt Lake City, the corner of 9th and 9th, and I don't know which 9th and 9th because I don't say, but I'm sure that you guys... 9th East and 9th South, kind of over by Liberty Park area. Okay, I know where that is. So on with this evening. We have a great lineup here, some fantastic folks who've graced this podium even today. Our first speaker will be Amy Chamberlain. She is the creator of Ask a Beehive. If you have not read that, you are missing out, let me tell you. It was featured in our Mormonism's first online humor magazine called The Sugar Bee. Many of Amy's columns were actually reprinted in the Mormon Tabernacle Enquirer. And she recently returned to Utah from an extended stay in Dubai. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of humor she brings from Dubai. Di Newman has changed out of his formal wear and will be modeling a very stylish shirt this evening. I thought it was stylish. He completed a degree in religion and culture at the University of Utah, and he's doing an MA in religion this fall at Syracuse University. He's fascinated by the interplay between popular culture and religion and by the commercialization of faith. He did a great presentation this afternoon. If you like what he said tonight, go get his CD. It's upstairs. It's about games Mormons play. And I think he did a couple other things this morning, too. Then we'll hear from Holly Welker, who will be introducing some of these LOL cats that we see up on the screen and talking about them. And Jana Reese is here. We saw her at dinner time. She is a co-author or editor of 9 books, including What Would Buffy Do?, Mormonism for Dummies, and a forthcoming humor memoir, Flunking Sainthood. Sainthood. That's also the name of a blog that she's working on. Although she's a spiritual failure and was never able to climb the rope in gym class, she has a doctorate from Columbia University. She teaches religion at Miami University, and she works as an editor in the publishing industry. So she's not a total loser. She blogs at blog.beliefnet.com flunking sainthood. That's another one. You know, all these great places that you can go reading, but don't read while you're here, you know, even though you got internet access. And Troy Williams will be rounding off the evening. He's the public affairs director of KRCL 90.9 FM in Salt Lake City and is the executive producer of Radioactive. His work has been featured in Interview Magazine, The Nation, The Gay Times, and Out Magazine. He's the co-author of the play, another one you gotta see, The Passion of Sister Dottie S. Dixon. Troy is currently featured in the new Errol Morris movie, documentary, gotta get my words straight, Tabloid. It's now in theaters. So we'll turn it over to the panelists in that order. Amy, Di, Holly, Jana, Troy, and then we'll close with a closing song. So, come on.
So I was telling Stephen that I think the reason this is a new experience for me, I've never presented a Sunstone, is that as a satire writer, satirist, someone who likes to, you know, poke fun at things, I'm usually, my modus operandi is to sit in the back and then snicker at things and poke someone and whisper. So I was always I still am the kid that people would shush, you know, and inappropriate things. So it's a little different for me to be in front of people talking. Let me kind of start out by telling you how Ask and Behave got started. I know that this is really small, but this is Mandy Meekum, Beehive of the Ask and Behave column. So, about 10 years ago, Chris Bigelow asked if anyone would like to get together to work on a satirical website. And I said, ooh, me. I would love to. So I did. We started working, and it was a lot of fun. At the time, I was surrounded with young women, just swimming in them. I spent all of my 20s working with them and yelling at them. And so I mostly worked with Laurels and My Maids, and I kind of understood that mindset, sort of. But I had three exposures to beehives that really stunned me. The first was, I had them in my car for 7 hours, four of them. We drove down to Lake Powell, and my brain just kind of froze after a while of listening to them. I can't even call it talking. I'm not really sure. Communicating in some primitive fashion. And they kept me awake, which was good. And then I guess my second exposure was someone had a craft activity that they did for all of the young women, so I went along with the Laurels. And the My Maids and Laurels could do it, and the Beehives just physically couldn't do it. They couldn't talk and glue photos at the same time. They couldn't listen and write. So by the time we were done, the My Maids had 4 or 5 pages, the Laurels had 6 or 7, and the Beehives just had scraps and scissors. There might have been one in the forehead of someone. It was just amazing to see how that particular subspecies of young women functioned. And then my third experience was the Beehive advisor had a sleepover party with the Beehives and wanted me to come and do an activity with them. And I thought, I don't think they do activities. I don't think they have enough coordination or brain power. This sounds really mean, but I was just trying to figure them out. I thought, I don't really know what to do with activities because I don't think they can handle playing a game and still socializing at the same time. So I came up with, actually had a little stroke of brilliance. And I found an activity that kept them focused, this laser-like intensity focused on what they were doing for the entire 2 hours. And it was this. Let's see if I can pull this up here. If I can go there, I'll show you. I'll just go here. These personality quizzes. Look how many there are. What's your High School Musical personality? What's your college personality? What's your perfume personality? What else do we have here? What's your strongest personality point? Seeing a pattern here? Aren't you just dying to know the answers yourself? What haircut matches your personality? Do you have an attention-craving personality? I think it's fair to say that if you're on the site, that yes, you do have an attention. And they just go on and on. Personality tests, eclipse quizzes, vampire quizzes, quizzes for girls. Am I a good kisser? That one had them very interested for a long, 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 long time. And we have beauty, how to do a messy bun, cut your own bangs, nail design. So honestly, for the entire 2 hours, I watched them transform from these sort of hyperactive puppies to, I'm going to learn everything I can about myself. And they took these so seriously. And not only did they take them, but then they wanted to turn to me and discuss all the deep insights they had just gotten about themselves. Like, did you know I'm really creative? Did you know I should probably cut my hair shorter? And their faces just lit up. I had never seen them that excited about anything, certainly not in church, about anything. And that was a great insight for me. I realized beehives are completely self-absorbed. And that's okay, because that's they're growing up, that's what they do. So as I was having that particular epiphany, which is perhaps not much of one, we were also discussing what kinds of things we wanted to do. That's not it. Let me go back over here. Yes. We knew we wanted to do an advice column, or several, on sugarbeet.com, which is sadly defunct. I wish, though, it would come back, because it was such a great outlet for me. It was perfect for my personality, sitting in the back and making snarky comments about things. I could do that from home. It was great. All the time, around the clock. We knew we wanted to do advice columns, and I liked the Onion's format, which, if you haven't seen it, here's one. Ask a movie trailer announcer guy. So if you can't see it, I'll read the first one to you. Dear movie trailer announcer guy, our 10-year-old son, Jonathan, has been begging us for a puppy for the past 4 months. I'm not sure he's responsible enough, but my husband says a pet might be just the thing to teach him a few tricks. What do you think? Here's the answer. It took him 24 years to forget the woman he left behind. Now he's got 24 hours to find her. In a world gone mad, sometimes madness is the only way to survive. When heaven falls, starts June 26th at theaters everywhere. So this amused us greatly, Ms. Sugarbeet. And I thought, I like the fact that you have an answer that reveals something about the person doing it. But I thought it would be funnier if the answer actually had something to do with the question, which these don't on the Onion. They go elsewhere. And so I don't know what it was, but it was thinking about these beehives that I was so curious about, sort of like a sociological, I felt like I was visiting a different tribe when I was around them. And then thinking about, I thought, advice columns, I could do that because look how short the answers are. I'm essentially a lazy person, so the people, the satirists here who've written novels, I'm in complete awe. I'm all about the short, easy, I can whip it off and then don't have to do any real work. That's kind of how I am. So that's how Ask a Beehive was born. And I got one of our great graphic designer to find me a picture of what I thought she would look like, and it went from there. So the format was either I would make up questions or people would send them in, and that was a lot more fun when people would send them in. And I loved the more intellectual and sort of obtuse and abstract they were, the better it was to give them to Mandy, I felt, because that was a lot of fun. So having said that, I've brought five of sort of readers' favorites from the years that we were online, and I thought I could let you decide as a group which ones of these you would like me to read. I'm in no way a really great dramatic reader, but I will do my best. I thought if I chose readers' favorites, then it would be a little better. Yes?
I choose Evolution.
Evolution. Anyone else? Or just yell them out. Okay, I'm hearing a pattern. You people are a little disturbing. I'll read sex. That sounded disturbing too. And then if there's time, maybe I'll hit up evolution, because that's always a fun one. So we've got scriptures. Here's the one about sex right here. So, okay, what now? Thanks. No, I don't know what you just told me to do. Okay. Yes. Full screen. I can lean over. Okay. Are you able to hear me okay? Because I'm away from the... All right. Dear Mandy, the scriptures tell us not to seek after riches, but every time we have a discussion concerning money in one of our meetings, someone always defends wealth by saying that the Lord wants us to be happy. Do you think God sometimes rewards the righteous with material possessions? A lot of my neighbors seem to think so. Mary Beth Larson. So this is her answer. Yep.
Let's put it right in
front. Right here?
Yeah. Does that sound better? Right?
Sorry.
It says it's the one on the right.
I'm sorry. This is the wealth one. Let's go to sex. That's where it is. I'm sorry. This is Beth. So, hang on.
No, you're good.
This is good?
You're good.
Okay. It does feel weird speaking this loudly. Like I said, I'm back of the room. Now the text is weird. What did I do? All right. I'm a 10-year-old girl. My mom keeps pulling me aside to ask me if I have any questions about sex. She gave me this really embarrassing talk last week on a flannel board that involved little flowers and bees and things. I about died. I want to tell her, relax, Mom, I've known this stuff since I was 5, but I don't want to hurt her feelings. What should I do? Name withheld. And this was a real question that I got, that she got. Okay, this man. Aw, that is just so sweet. Your mom seriously sounds way cute. Old people can get so mental about the talk, can't they? It is so touching to watch them sometimes. Okay, the thing is that old people like moms need to try and feel all down with their kids and feel all bonded to them. That's a word that my mom uses 24/7. It means that they are getting all freaked out about getting more and more ancient, so they have to try and talk to their kids about sex and other things like that, that like young people get to do. My friend Lindsay's mom is always on her case about not having sex, and she's all, duh, I won't. But her mom still stresses about it. Lindsay's older sister, Mackenzie, thinks that her mom is all obsessed with the subject because she is old and creaky. I think she's almost 45. And probably doesn't have energy for sex anymore and is jealous. Mackenzie says that it's called displacement, but I think that's her C+ from her high school psychology class talking, so I'm all, whatever. The thing is, you totally need to let your mom do her little flannel board story. Remember that Christ said, humor thy parents so your days on the earth will be long. Just think about it. She's an old person. She's probably too tired to have sex anyway, so all she can do is sit around the house and knit and eat prunes and have anxiety disorders about what her kids are doing. Let her give you the 411 on that special thing that you only do when you're married. That's what my mom calls it. I'm so not kidding. Yeah, Mom, whatever. Like, I don't watch Gossip Girl. Anyway, practice listening with an attentive look on your face. If you look like you're totally into it, your mom will be down with that. My hint? Mentally go through your wardrobe and match up some slammin' outfits. It will totally pass the time, and your mom can do her old person thing and feel better about herself. Besides, it's way cute that she waited until you were 10 so that you could have an innocent childhood. Don't ruin that idea for her, or you will feel totally bummed. So, words of wisdom from a 12-year-old. I guess we can do another one. Are there any topics? Should we hit evolution, or is there another one that you'd like to do? Okay. Okay. This is a real question, too. Over the past 10 years, molecular biologists have amassed a vast body of new evidence supporting the theory of evolution, which was already accepted as fact by almost everyone in the scientific community. Bruce R. McConkie, on the other hand, taught that evolution was not just wrong, but an evil and pernicious heresy. Who should I believe, the scientists or Elder McConkie? I thought that would be fun. Answer. It is so rad when religious dudes and science dudes fight, because the rest of us can totally score. Just like that one episode of The Brady Bunch where Carol and Mike got into a big fight about whether or not Jan could go to a dance, and they were so into it that she just sneaked out and went to the dance and scored a cute guy. The religious guys are Carol, the science guys are Mike, and while they're arguing, the rest of us can get our dance groove on. Because, like, okay, I totally never used to care about evolution back when I was young and immature. But then my biology teacher last year, Mr. Wang, ramped up on this way harsh evolution unit and was all like, all this stuff will be on your midterm. So I went all ballistic and started to actually study and stuff, like with books and everything. But it was so way impossible. There are all these huge words in the book like Cro-Magnon Man. And I just about went mental, even though I was studying with Stacy, and even though we had KJQ turned way down low and even turned off VH1. I am not kidding. It was way harsh. So then it was like 3 a.m. and we had the test in the morning and we had to improvise, and we came up with this way genius plan. We got dressed for school in our churchiest clothes, which are these really lame Puritan dresses with buttons down the front and, no, I am not lying, actual round collars that our moms totally forced us to buy for this totally weak steak music program that we had to do because we were caught driving Stacy's sister's car when she let us do, because we recalled this guy who was stalking her and freaked him out by pretending we were social workers, which was way tight. So anyways, we went up to Mr. Wang and we were all, dude, we totally can't take this test because our parents don't believe in evolution and they don't want us to study it. Stacy even cried, which is so completely whacked. She has this thing where she spritzes nail polish remover in her eye way fast. And then she just tears right up and everyone feels all sorry for her, and it works way better for getting out of things even than a classic girl problems excuse. So anyways, Mr. Wang is all buggin' because he hasn't lived in Utah that long and he doesn't know anything about Mormons, so he totally eats it up. Sweet. We got to blow off the test and just write an essay about religious persecution instead, which we totally scored on because Stacy's dad has encyclopedias and we just copied stuff. But now I'm way more mature and I totally believe in evolution because, duh, just look at boys. Most boys my age are proof that we are descended from monkeys, or at least boys are. They have hairy backs, serious hygiene issues, and even make the same kinds of noises. I mean, even the thing about monkeys flinging poo is like boys. And if you don't believe me, just ask Braxton about his latest scout campout. Yeah. So. So. I mean, the great thing about, I think, the Young Women's Program in general is there is so much to satirize in it. I'm sure there are other great things about it, too, but that's the first thing that comes to my mind. I mean, we have kids who their primary form of self-expression is irony, and they are represented by visuals like this one. I think, you know, and I know they've just changed this, they've just replaced it, but There's such a disconnect, I think, by the way that the church sees young women and the way that the young women see themselves. And I think they know a whole lot more than they're generally given credit for. You can see that, you know, Mandy's kind of a smart aleck and knows a couple of things. So I guess there's a lot more room there. I could probably continue doing her forever. Our website, unfortunately, is no longer existent. So I'm kind of trying to figure out what to do with her next. She's on Twitter, and that's kind of fun, but I don't know, maybe I'm thinking about maybe doing a blog where she's, you know, asking for questions and then answering them, so, but I'm lazy, so I haven't bothered to create one yet. Anyway, so that's kind of the future of it. Also, I don't know if this is for sale anymore anywhere, but this is the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer of it.
They have some yeah. upstairs at Benchmark.
Oh, they do. They have it upstairs. So this not only has Mandy, but all kinds of great things by some really, really incredible Mormon satirists, including Holly Welker. She was part of the group for a long time, and that was a lot of fun working with her, and Stephen Carter himself. So this is where you can find all of that stuff. So thank you for listening.
So first of all, I'm going to put out my Angel Moroni, which people who don't know me, when they come into my house, are often surprised by when they see that I have Angel Moroni has a pride of place. Because I hold these sort of like weird theological positions, and then they come in and they see the giant Utah flag, and they see the Angel Moroni, and they can't compute what's going on. A couple of years years ago, I was at the Salt Lake County Fair, browsing among the vendor tables. Amid the kitchen gadgets, cutesy jewelry, and the plaster sculptures of dogs with Confederate flags, I saw something that I still cannot entirely make sense of. I saw young women's value panties. Each article was the color of the value and had the name boldly printed on the back. I'm not quite sure who would want to have divine nature or choice and accountability splayed out across their backside, but I do kind of love the idea of wearing underwear emblazoned with virtue on it. It's as if to remind yourself that chastity must be maintained, or given the location of the word, that to remind your partner to know to not go any further. As I have yet to see these for sale anywhere else, and believe me, I have tried. I can only assume, or if I'm being really honest, hope that the idea proved less stellar to consumers than it did to the whoever came up with it. I hope as I carry on here with this presentation about Mormon kitsch that nobody takes my jibes about Mormon ganda too personally. You're welcome to make fun of my taste all you want in turn. After all, I own no fewer than 6 Mormon tie tacks, a Moroni, a Salt Lake Temple, a 3 degree symbol, a Liahona, a Salt Lake Temple doorknob, and a beehive, all of which I wear non-ironically. One of the problems I had when coming up with what to talk about for this presentation is there is simply so much stuff out there. I don't know for sure if Mormons are more prone to producing this sort of stuff, and doubt that they are, but the internet has created a situation of near overwhelming possibilities. Thanks to sites like Zazzle, Cafe Press, and Spreadshirt, anybody can create and sell t-shirts, magnets, and other fabric items, including, they do now sell a thong with all the young women's values printed on it, which isn't quite as delightful, I don't think, as the individual ones, but if you're looking for a good substitute, you can go to Cafe Press and find it. The website Etsy allows individuals to turn traditional crafts into businesses, and also gone is the process of trying, and most likely failing, to get your goods into a Deseret Book in order to have a Mormon audience for them. You can slap up a webpage with your stuff, ask friends to like it on Facebook, and go too. Now, most of these goods sold online are probably not that successful, but they exist, and often, even after they stop seeming like a good idea to whoever came up with them, the images are stored online for people like me to dig up. To even give a sample of the vast array of things would take much, much longer than I have time for, but as a teeny tiny taste, online you can buy wedding cake toppers in glass, which is over there, in the shape of every LDS temple. This is the old Ogden temple. This one, unfortunately, does not show the optional puffed glass hearts, but there is the metal angel Moroni on top. You can also buy an oil vial engraved with your personal priesthood line to remind yourself. But not right now. They're on summer hiatus. So you'll have to wait until after Labor Day in order to buy those. There are handkerchiefs sold specifically for a temple dedication with embroidered images and the date of the dedication. Or, if that's not functional enough for you, you can order an envelope for your temple clothes with a lacy edging and embroidered with white on white, of course, the temple that you most frequently attend. There's also the Traveler, a miniature sacrament kit that has a small tray for bread, a 6-slot water cup holder, a card for the prayers, and a makeshift white tablecloth, all in a waterproof case to fit in your backpack. The website selling these knows that insecurity sells very well, and asks those who stumble upon it, have you ever felt just a little bit conspicuous or uncomfortable as you carry 2 large sacrament trays down the street or through a parking lot into a hospital or nursing home as you went about your assignment to take the sacrament to someone who is ill or unable to attend meetings regularly? Because the last thing you would want, of course, is for people to know that the 2 men in white shirts and ties carrying bread into a hospital are Mormons. There are also elastics in the shape of the Salt Lake Temple and the CTR shield called Righteous Bands. These are hoping to cash in on the popularity, which I think is fading now, but might not be entirely gone, of those silly bands. There are CTR rings in all their variety. Angel Moroni necklaces and young women charm bracelets with items such as the footprint for faith, a crown for divine nature, and a temple for virtue. Or if you want to remind yourself of the best 2 years of your life, you can get a ring with a CTR shield. But instead of the standard green filling or whatever other filling in the word CTR, it has the flag of where you serve your mission in it. This dual layer of Mormonness, the CTR symbol and your mission, is astounding to me. And At a mere $25 for this ring, it sure beats out the cost of the $345 mission ring like this guy that has a large gemstone in the center, Angel Moroni on the side, and the name of your mission around the ring, around the stone. All of these examples don't even begin to unpack those things that sort of cross the boundary between do-it-yourself and, like, art. Like those vinyl letter sayings that you can put on your wall, because you'll, you know, like, why pay someone to do something you can do yourself, right? My favorite example I see by far is one on the bottom that says, "No success can compensate for failure in the home," which is super useful if you're not getting enough guilt trips already. As I troll through the websites for these items, I come across phrases with alarming regularity about how the creators felt inspired to design their goods and how they were doing the work that the Holy Spirit sent them on. While Mormons are not the only ones to speak about the religious goods in this manner, I do wonder how the emphasis on personal revelation plays into someone getting the courage to attempt to market their brainstorm. With all these options out there, it was exceptionally difficult to choose what to focus on. In fact, I could take up the rest of my time just sharing more examples like this in rapid succession, but I do want to focus in on two items, the Mormon t-shirt and the Mormon toy. I can see the appeal of t-shirts for Mormons. They're missionary tools, they're functional, they're easy to wash, they can be handed down from person to person, and so on. Also, as I mentioned above, anybody can make a t-shirt these days with a basic knowledge of Photoshop and an internet connection. If you go looking for Mormon shirts online, though, you can tell which ones are made by people who get it, who are on the inside, and those who don't. A search on the website Cafe Press, for instance, for when you search for Mormon, returns a lot of polygamy results, such as the "I heart, heart, heart polygamy," or the one that compares a Massachusetts wedding, 2 grooms, and a Utah wedding, 1 groom, 3 brides. Another option of these people who I don't think quite get what Mormons are about is a dinosaur that's crying and the phrase underneath, "Mormons don't believe in me." The polygamy shirts are not funny or offensive, just sort of dumb to me, but the dinosaur one just simply doesn't make sense. Are there Mormons who don't believe in dinosaurs? Clearly the better option would be to have a crying Lucy, you know, the first human, crying and say, "Mormons don't believe in me" underneath. Or "Mormons don't think I have a soul" or something along those lines. There are other Mormon shirts that used to be sold, but no longer. My favorites of these ones include the one that I am modeling right now, which is the "I Love Mormon Boys" and red smiley face, which I used to wear on BYU campus and get lots of really odd looks. No one would ever approach me about it. They would just look at me and be like as if I had, like, grabbed the wrong shirt or something. The other one I love is this one that is the Tide logo, "Best Replacement with Repent, Tough on Sins." The loss of these two items for sale does not mean there's a shortage of Mormon shirts. Mormon shirts, and by this term I mean shirts made for Mormons as opposed to those that I mentioned above that are made about Mormons, run the gamut from serious to silly, from clever to insipid, and from cheeky to sincere. Some of them rely on a currency of vocabulary that only Mormons and highly informed outsiders would be familiar with. This one, if you can't see, it says, "I'm of Ephraim." I'm not sure what the point is of this shirt, though. Is it pride to be from Ephraim? It is rather handy, though, but thanks, you know, there's not enough to make one for all 12 tribes, right? Because everyone's of Ephraim or Manasseh or Judah, so we're good to go. But I think a shirt that would be more interesting would be "I'm of Asher" or "I'm of Naphtali." Whether it's true or not, I think it'd be great to wear them around. It's not only doctrine in terms like this that is fodder for shirts. One of these, and I apologize for the quality of this, but this is the "Shape of Utah" made out of Utah swears. Like frick, H double hockey shit, six, shiz, and so on. BYU honor code restrictions also get a shirt, like this one that says, "I broke the honor code, don't worry, it didn't involve chastity or the word of wisdom." This shirt reminds me of a set of shirts my friend made at BYU that he sadly did not mass produce. They were made to challenge the facial hair rule, and my two favorites were "Shave Always, That You May Come Off Conqueror," and "I Don't Shave, But I Don't Masturbate Either." One shirt that places the post-resurrection "No rally team mates and Jerry have Jesus into the mouth of pre-missionary boys with, "Hold me not, for I have not yet served my mission." It is always alarming to me when I find something that makes me cringe because I find it sacrilegious. I have an astounding high threshold for this. But surely taking the words of Jesus and turning them into a joke about sexual purity bothers me. Yet I find the fact that someone would compare the crowning mystery of Christianity with serving a mission suggestive of how important this rite of passage is for young men. There's also this little green one, which is an imaginative teen shirt called the Tiancum Javelins. If you look beyond text itself, Mormons also use images for shirts. This becomes tricky, though, because Mormonism does not have a clear iconography for its holy people. There are exceptions, but for whatever reasons, few characters or figures can be presented with a shorthand that some other religions have. Like, you know, the saints all have their attributes, so if you see the keys, you know it's Peter, and so on. Therefore, even these shirts of people have names, such as Stripling Warrior, alongside an image of a young man who could only gain those muscles with steroids. These are true hero shirts, not to be confused with those real hero computer-designed ones, that, like the Dreamboat Joseph with the gold plates and the daughters in the wilderness. Esther here, and you probably can't tell, but she has that sort of like East Asian look that fantasy heroines get for some reason. It's like the future, we're all going to be like vaguely East Asian, except for this is Esther in the past. Also, Moroni's title here is written in the Hebrew alphabet, which bothers me so much more than it should. And Noah is looking quite fine at age 600. I hope I look better at 16. Also, his skirt is super short. I don't know why. This shirt of Nephi with the sword. With the sword and the liahona held in a cupped hand just below the waist, makes me very uncomfortable. I'm pretty sure I've been warned about pictures like this. This shirt is marketed to young men and missionaries, and I'm not sure what message it's trying to send, but with the eroticism and the slogan, "Just go and do it," a very different message is being sent to me. Thanks to internet shirt ordering, anything can be put on a shirt these days, so Choose the Rad has marketed its comics for these purposes.
If you can read it, it says, "Though less well known the title of Liberty, as a child, Captain Moroni also raised the title of Dessert Before Dinner and the title of Later Bedtime."
The last shirt I want to share is one whose target market is very small indeed, but which I love. What better way to make people feel comfortable with your same-sex attraction than asking them, just by putting on your shirt, "Why would our Heavenly Father do this to anyone?" Before I move on to Mormon toys, I want to make a little detour on hand carts. Mormon culture right now is lousy with them. I understand the price paid by hand cart saints was great, and they should be honored, but it does seem a little bit out of proportion. 3,000 pioneers came in handcart companies. It only takes 3 days in the summer for the same number of tourists to pass through the Martin Coast Visitor Center, which is in the middle of nowhere, Wyoming. The visual image of handcart pioneers is everywhere, as are trinkets to memorialize recreations of the trek that you've just gone on. This one up here, the keychain, which you probably can't see very well, but you should look up online. On one side has a vision of the first vision, it's Joseph in the Grove, and the other side has a boot next to a handcart wheel. Few other objects to me so neatly summarize the Mormon conception of their faith's history. Joseph got some revelations, some people charged to Utah. It's a neat two-image encapsulation of everything that seems to matter. I think the best way to maximize it, though, if around the edge, you know, like some coins had put on the edge, if it just put, "Families can be forever." It'd be the true trifecta then.
You can also get this crystal cube of laser handcart pioneers by Ringmasters. They've branched out from their rings. They also sell a neat little stand that lights up and rotates, so you can appreciate the tragedy from all sides. Another keychain, this one, has a horrifying thought attached to it to me. The phrase is trekking to eternity. Now, I assume and I hope that they mean trekking metaphorically, but perhaps this is literal. Maybe God will make us pull a handcart for the rest of time. Now, this seems sort of cruel, but personally, I think this would be a better myth to perpetuate than the one that the handcart pioneers will bow down for those youth who grew up during President Hinckley's day. Of course, if you want to recreate the handcart experience, you don't need to go on a trek or buy these things. You can buy a set of vinyl handcart pioneers. Now, it's weird to me because pioneers, what we sort of remember them about them is the tragedy, so it's like, look, these people died, yay! But I guess I shouldn't be too harsh because I collect Noah's Ark toys, which was the destruction of the entire like human race. So handcarts are kind of minor compared to that. So I have the toys in front of me, and it might be sort of hard to see, which I apologize about, but if you're really desperate afterwards, you can come and I'll let you touch my things. Perhaps the most infamous of all Mormon toys are the Book of Mormon action figures. Right here, this is not actually Book of Mormon, people, but this is Joseph receiving the plates from Angel Moroni, and if you notice, there's even a hole where he took them out of. This is Lehi. And right here we have the brother of Jared. And what I love about this one is his stones light up. They glow in the dark. So these are brought to us by the same people who made those handcart pioneers. In theory, it seems like a good idea, but I've always been bothered that they're not really action figures. They're more like inaction figures. They just stand there. Because real action figures, you can pose them and move them and think about them creatively. These are just inert. But I imagine I would have gotten bored trying to play with these as a kid. Yet doesn't the fact that they stay in tableau with one proper pose speak volumes about the ways in which scripture functions in Mormon thought? The Book of Mormon and other stories have only one correct way to be read, and you should never deviate from that. In a similar vein is the magnetic storybooks, where you can recreate scenes from the Book of Mormon. So this is one example. This one, you got the waters of Mormon on one side, and the wicked priests of Noah on the other, and they're going to die. And of course, because we know Arnold Freiberg was inspired, right? You've got the jaguars or leopards or whatever for a band, which is so interesting to me. I can't believe they had pet leopards. I think I would have been the wicked priest if that was on offer. Oh, there's also llamas, which is a nice touch for that series too. You know, this is one of my favorites. This is a Nephi doll, but it's not just a doll. It's a doll that talks.
Where's the speaker? Can you hear?
Angels speak to the Holy Ghost. The other one was my soul delights in the Lord. Pray always. Everybody should have charity. Unfortunately, the company that made these has gone defunct. They were originally going to create a whole line of them for various Book of Mormon prophets. I'm sort of bothered by this, though, because we have Nephi's own words in the scriptures. He writes in the first person, but they like translate them into like modern English. Like, why would you do that? Are they, do you think kids are not going to be able to like understand it if the doll instead of the scriptures are saying it? Like, I don't understand the disconnect. These two guys, or four guys, are mini missionaries. They look to me a little bit like they would have passed the new raised bar weight limit, so we'll chubby. But they are compatible with standard Fisher-Price little people sets. I think this speaks clearly to how the Mormon product mind works. They aren't trying to reinvent the wheel. Instead, they're trying to follow the path of successful products, such as simply rebranding the game with a Mormon name on it. And they're not meant to replace anything, necessarily, only supplement. However, these missionaries will stay missionaries forever. If you integrate them into your little people sets, the other humans will go off and do other things, but these guys will be stuck in their white shirts always. It's always their mission and never PA. So I have two sets here. These are the standard ones, and these are the, I kid you not, ethnic missionaries. If you can see, one is sort of Asian and one is brown. And the brown guy is the only one with eyebrows. But not only do they have eyebrows, they're like, one is cocked in this really saucy, like, hey, how you doing? The last toy I have to share is the Leah Homer. This is the plastic version. There's also a bronze version and an old version, but I'm too cheap for that. It has a compass needle on the inside, and then another one you can move. I don't really understand, like, the conception of how this works in these events. But there's also, like, weird symbols that I guess are the compass directions, but they're, like, just scribbles, so Reformed Egyptian looks like it's really hard. These are marketed with saying they have sayings on the inside that change, and so I originally thought that it was going to be like a magic eight ball. The truth, though, is rather disappointing. It's hard to even see what it says, but they say it one, follow the follow the Lord and trust the Spirit, or follow the Spirit and trust the Lord, or something like that. There's something really generic, very disappointing. This disappointed me at first, but then I saw that perhaps the creators had done something very clever. Just as David Mayen claims that Yahweh is fond of double meanings and seldom clear, the Leah Homer probably offered vague advice. Our goal as Mormons is to turn that vague, hard-to-read advice into something applicable and useful. Which is, like, probably better for us when it's not like, you want us to go out of the wilderness and go, where? Like, can you just be a little clearer versus knowing, like, oh, you should, like, pray and stuff. So I know my presentation and discussion of these items has seemed probably very scattered and largely without a broader speculation, but this is because, for all my efforts, I'm still unsure what to make of all these goods. The vast range shows how Mormons use witty slogans on shirts to both poke fun at the culture or uphold it. There are affirmations and jokes, but fundamentally, t-shirts like the ones I share are an act of identification. The wearer owns a Mormonness by buying and wearing them. In fact, they not only own a Mormonness, but often a theological or cultural position inside Mormonism by how cheeky the shirt is or by what is poked fun of or what is held up to be admirable. Toys also serve an identification purpose, but the role is more private and home-based. The goal is to set young children on the path to identifying themselves as Mormons, to grow up to be the kind of person who serves a mission, knows Book of Mormon stories, respects pioneer heritage, and so on. Which raises a question for me that I don't have an answer to. It's one thing for adults like me with a disposable income to buy these things on a lark. It's quite another to give them to a young child to play with. What messages are we sending with these toys? And what does it say about gender that I have yet to see any Mormon toys directly geared towards girls? Do boys need more help identifying as Mormon? Are non-Mormon toys good enough for girls? There's a lot of tricky questions that I think this gender aspect raises. As I said earlier, I hope I haven't pricked anybody's taste by selecting these things, and I hope my own fondness for these goods has shown through. I really do love them. I gladly spend my money on these things because they amuse me, they delight me, and they speak to a deep need inside of me to let myself and others know that I'm a Mormon.
So I am going to read an introduction to the slideshow we're about to watch. It was written by someone named Mel Walker. I've never met him. My connection to this is that I worked at Sunstone over the summer, and I had the job of trimming a file of over 700 images down to less than 300. I have to tell you, it was one of my favorite jobs. And I had to get rid of all the truly dirty ones. because we didn't want to. So yeah. I left one or two kind of bad ones. Hopefully you will still laugh. And also, we tried to get rid of the ones that would be most upsetting. We tried. I don't know. They're cats with... All right, anyway. Okay, so this is Mel's introduction. Cut from a mountain without hands, rolling forth to fill the earth, destroying the somber gods of soberness, and completely ruining any chance of avoiding loud laughter and light-mindedness, came the Lol Damn You's thread on FLAC. A few things you should know. FLAC stands for Further Light and Knowledge, and is an online forum about Mormonism populated primarily by people intensely interested in Mormon culture, belief, and practices without being devout. In fact, they're often the opposite of devout. Instead, FLAC is part of the Damn You, or the Disaffected Mormon Underground. Lolcats were not invented on FLAC. Regardless of who first had the brilliant idea of writing humorous, grammatically incorrect captions to photos of cats, we may never know, the practice was popularized by the website I Can Hash Cheeseburger. Trends quickly emerged, and among the most relevant for our presentation this evening is the designation of a benevolent feline deity called Ceiling Cat and a wicked feline demon called Basement Cat. The Lol Damn You's thread was started by Canadian cynic in the late morning of Thursday, January 31st, 2008, a few days after the death of Gordon B. Hinckley, with a photo of a cat and a caption reading, "Packer Cat says, one down, one to go." Other photos quickly followed and readers were hooked. The author of the fifth post nominated the thread for best thread ever, an early sign of its greatness. The majority of the photos have always featured cats, but soon we saw photos of other animals, including dogs, hamsters, anteaters, and convicted document forgers. Then Mel Walker came along. Mel has this to say about his involvement in the thread. "I assumed the name Galdarn and started contributing to FLAC. I claimed that the Lol Damn You's thread was a main reason I joined FLAC and proceeded to post the first of my 180 lolcats. I've given some thought over the months as to why I make lolcats. When I started, I didn't have any deeper meaning in mind. I just liked the lolcats, and so the thread appealed to me. In the year or so I lurked before joining, I loved laughing at them, so when I joined, it just seemed natural to contribute to the thread. Victor Borges said, laughter is the shortest distance between two people, and I know it was true with me. I felt welcome to FLAC with open arms, much more than I felt at my then-current ward. I received applause, praise, and one marriage proposal, which prompted my wife to join FLAC, too. Since we were both in the process of leaving the church, it was good for both of us to have a place where we could be accepted, ask questions, and have friends. Many of my lolcats drew from the temple ceremonies. Don't worry, we won't show those tonight. Your personal covenants will still be intact, should still be intact when this plenary is over. But even before I began my magnum opus, the Lol Dowment, and if you're curious, you should look that up. He did the endowment ceremony in Lol speak. Comedy is simply a funny way of being serious, said Peter Ustinov. In my case, at least, it was true. I was an active temple goer. At one time in my ward, I may well have been the most active attendee who wasn't actually a temple worker. It was a hard time for me in my religious life. I had quit going to priesthood meeting, although I can't for the life of me remember why, but I never stopped going to the temple. The bishop mentioned that when he called me to task about attendance. How could I renew a recommend later if I didn't attend priesthood? When I looked back, it is clear to me how desperate I wanted the church to make sense to me, to be fruitful, to be worthwhile. My patriarchal blessing said I would find great joy in serving in high and holy places, and I latched onto that phrase as a life preserver in stormy seas. But the temple didn't help. In the end, the lolcats did. As I moved on from being Mormon, the lolcats trickled off. As I thought about Mormonism less and less, the secular lolcats I still read every day don't evoke a creative response like they did before. I never finished the Lol Dowment and probably never will. The impetus just isn't there anymore. I'm grateful for the... And I love this. I realize this is a meta comment, but as I was editing this a little bit and shaping it, I love how at the end he still bears his testimony. I am grateful for the Lol Damn You's thread. It played a large role in helping me move on. It let me use the only truly effective weapon I had against my lifetime of indoctrination, laughter. I think it worked. I hope it helps others. I'd like to end with one more quote from the great actor Zero Mostel. Comedy is rebellion against that kind of piety which we may call the false piety, against hypocrisy, against pretense, against falsehood and humbug and bunk and fraud, against false promise and base deceivers, against all evil masquerading as true and good and worthy of respect. To me, that's the Laldamuse thread right there. I hope you and any future FLAC readers enjoy it as much as I did, with loud laughter and a lot of it. And I'm going to hope that this slideshow works, so...
And for the last almost 2 years, I've been doing this project on Twitter and Facebook called The Twible. And it is a humor project that is modeled after what would The Onion say if The Onion were to go through every chapter of the Bible. So every day, I tweet out a chapter of the Bible in 140 characters or less, with approximately 68% more humor than was in the original Bible. And if you would like to follow on Twitter, if you are on Twitter, I'm at Jana Reese, I before E. And I'm also on Facebook, happy to friend perfect strangers. So the Twible has been written up a couple of places. This was on CNN's religion blog last year. And then this was in The Guardian last summer, which was great, actually, because The Guardian is picked up all around the world. And so I suddenly had Twible followers in wonderful places like Bhutan, and so that's been really, really fantastic. All right, so what am I doing, and what am I learning in this project? Lesson number one, there is a lot of crazy crap in the Bible. The reason that I started this project, well, two reasons. One was that I realized that, I was in a hotel room in California, which is the birthplace of all very strange ideas, and I had to look something up in the hotel nightstand Bible. And then I realized as I was sitting there that just how much of the Bible I never read, in fact, have never read. And so I wanted to do that. And I tried those things where you read the Bible before. And I thought, I'm never going to do that by myself. So I need other people to hold me accountable. But let's also make it fun. And the other thing was that I was interested in using Twitter for something other than tweeting about what I ate for breakfast. And so this seemed like a good thing to do. However, at the time, I had no idea that there were actually 1,189 chapters in the Bible. Really bad idea. All right. So in the crazy crap category, I'm going to go ahead and read this aloud, although I normally hate people who read what's on PowerPoint just for the recording here. This is from Leviticus 15. Bodily discharge, very bad. In both genders, wash your sheets. Don't even think about having sex. You just thought it, didn't you? Okay, also in the crazy category, the wacky laws of the Bible. There are so many, it was very hard to choose for tonight. Deuteronomy 14, from don't boil kid in mom's milk, we get different pots for meat and dairy. I can't has cheeseburger. Why do we make religion hard? You know, in the Twible, I'm trying to entertain. You know, this is primarily a fun project, and I'm so glad when people tell me they're enjoying it. But it is also, it has a point. I am often struggling with some of the things that I find out in the Bible, as we'll see in a moment. But the question, I think, is a legitimate one. Why do we make religion hard? Wacky Laws continued. I love this one. Deuteronomy 21. If you find a murdered body, kill a cow nearby. And have all suspects lay hands on it. Why don't they do this in Law and Order? Did anybody know that was in the Bible? Because I never knew that was in the Bible. It seems like it would solve a lot of crime. Lesson number two, God flunked niceness in primary. So here's something from Leviticus chapter 10. Oh no, two of Aaron's sons lay altar fire incorrectly, so ever merciful God burns them up. It's tough to be the preacher's kids. How many of you know this story from the book of Leviticus? Okay, so a handful of people. I did not know this story until I put it together that actually this is where that Indigo Girls song, Strange Fire, comes from. That's from this passage. So online, I found, you know, this wonderful website called thebricktestament.com. If you've never seen it, you must go. So I want to tell the story of Aaron's two sons from the Brick Testament. So here we have them. I've called them Elder Nadab and Elder Abihu. And they look so sweet and earnest. They're so adorable. However, don't get too attached to them. So they lay the altar fire incorrectly, and they're toast. So what kind of God is this, exactly? Also, we're missing the actual tribal part, which is at the bottom of this. Well, that's interesting. So the story of Noah's Ark, the tweet is they've de-arked, but God... tells them that he will never off us by flood, keeps earthquakes, tsunamis in reserve. I'm particularly proud that I think I invented the verb de-arc. Oh, there it is. Oh, God sends a rainbow to promise he'll never again off us by flood, keeps earthquakes, tsunamis in reserve. All right, the Midianites. This is a story that I had known about in the Old Testament, but I had never put it into context. Reading the entire Bible through, you start to understand a little bit of the context. So, Numbers 31. In Exodus, Midianites were our friends, but now God says to kill them all except the virgins so we can rape them later. Why? So, the history here is that the Midianites were the people who sheltered Moses for 40 years after he had fled Egypt. He had killed someone and then he married a Midianite woman, Jethro, his father-in-law, that really nice guy who gave him all the advice, also a Midianite. So you kind of wonder when Moses came home that day and he was in the tent with Zipporah. Awkward. All right, what else do we know about God? Here's the tribal overview of Leviticus. Don't eat this. Don't screw that. Don't touch this. Don't do that. Thus saith the Lord. Lesson number three. The Bible is wonderfully human. That has been one of the most beautiful discoveries for me. And here we have tribal Song of Solomon, chapter 7. What happened to pick up lines like, your breasts are like twin gazelles? I mean, really, try it in a bar. I just dare you. So right now, on Facebook and Twitter, what the tribal followers are seeing is the end of the book of Proverbs. Like next week, we will get to Proverbs 31, everyone's very favorite one. But I'm actually doing the Song of Solomon right now because I work a little bit ahead, and I am having so much fun. All right, so in the Bible, with all of this human element, there's great pain. Here's Psalm 13. Where are you, God? I've been looking all over. Are you dissing me? My life sucks. I need to vent, and you are AWOL. Some friend. How long? That's actually one of my favorite psalms. Now, remember that the tribal is only correct insofar as it's translated correctly. So, you know, it does lose a little bit in translation. So also in the pain realm, I really was surprised by how nourishing and beautiful the book of Job was when I did it in context. So Job 29, Job offers closing argument as his own defense counsel. My life used to be so blessed. I helped the poor. What the F happened, G? God. Twivel Job 30, now I'm mocked and hated. Why? And why is God not answering my call? Oh, and my skin is falling off? What is up with that? And there's also love. So I realized this wonderful epiphany that actually the book of Ruth had been written by Jane Austen, which I didn't know until I did the Twibble, and then suddenly it all made sense. So here we have Ruth chapter 2. Jane Austen plot in ancient setting, destitute Ruth goes a-gleanin' and meets eligible bachelor Boaz Darcy, who saves her family. We also find inadequate religion throughout the Bible, and I here have this Job chapter 15, friend of Job number 1, who says, Job, you're undermining mom, religion, tradition, and green bean casserole. You make me nervous with your questions. But also back in the scene that we saw just a moment ago about Aaron's two sons who are killed. So after that, Moses and Aaron are standing there. They're sort of looking at this place where Aaron's sons had been standing just moments before. And Moses gives him this little homily about holiness and piety and how it's so necessary. And then the Bible just says, Aaron stood silent. And I just really cracked up. Yeah, so inadequate religion. When religion is inadequate for answering questions of human suffering. And there are beautiful signs of human failing in the Bible. So this is the New Testament, which I won't get to until God knows when. John 21, Jesus Christ to Peter, do you love me with agape love? Peter says, sure, Lord, I friended you on Facebook. And Jesus says, fair enough, feed my lambs. Now, that actually is sort of a reflection on the fact that the conversation that they're having, they're using two different verbs for love. So when Jesus says, do you love me? He is saying, do you love me with the love that God uses for humanity? And Peter says, yeah, we're buds. Peter uses a different verb for love. They repeat the conversation. Peter uses that same verb, which is, I friend you. I friended you on Facebook. And then the third time, Jesus says, do you friend me? And Peter says, yes, Lord, you know, I friend you. And so the conversation that they're having is not necessarily one that we get in English, but I think theologically it's a really important point about Jesus making accommodations for what we are able to give. And then there is this wonderful challenge of doing all 10 commandments in 140 characters or less. So we have Exodus 20, G's top 10, no gods, idols, blasphemy, keep Sabbath holy and love mom, don't kill, cheat, steal, lie, or look at Christmas catalogs. I was pretty proud that day. All right, and then the last thing I wanted to say, like I said, I would be honored to friend anyone on Facebook. I also have this book coming out in November called Flunking Sainthood. I'll be speaking about that here on Saturday morning. And it is a humorous memoir of 12 months of failing miserably at different spiritual practices. So if you have ever fallen short with things like fasting or keeping the Sabbath, please come and we can commiserate together. Thank you.
Hey everybody, I don't have any cool PowerPoint pictures, but I did bring free CDs, so you can come get those at the end of my presentation. I need to power myself up. Alright, I'm Troy. So, first off, thanks for having me, and I don't want to join the network here. I read today that there is a brand new Mormon defense league that has been launched to correct inaccurate statements made about the LDS faith in the media. And that makes me glad. And I think it's only fair. You are not legit as a persecuted minority until you have your very own anti-defamation league. So, all you Sunstone presenters better be on your toes this weekend, because there could be a mass deployment out of the Sandy Expo Center coming for you. That's where the fair conference is. Like, I for one, plan on being on. A couple of you get that. Plan on being on my best behavior today. But I think that the emergence of this League of Extraordinary Apologists is no doubt a response to America's so-called Mormon moment. Mass media has placed Mormonism right smack in the middle of everywhere. Broadway, HBO, Fox News, Newsweek, and of course, the most influential and prestigious medium of all, reality TV. Now, didn't it feel for a while like every single reality TV show had a gay Mormon? Survivor had one, Project Runway had one, and yes, in a couple weeks on Lifetime, I'm going to be on Roseanne's Nuts. So, yes, gay Mormons are the go-to stock characters these days, and I can always hear the producers working it out. We need conflict in our series, so let's throw in that tortured gay Mormon. He's got aches, pain, parent issues, he'll be perfect. And so, mass media, in a sense, is the very essence of kitsch. It's wonderfully reductive and sensational. However, the most appealing Mormons on TV are not your average suburban Sandy housewives. No, the ones that find themselves in front of the camera are always the transgressive and perverse characters from Mormondom. We just can't help ourselves. The polygamists and the queers are just coming out everywhere we can. The LDS Church taught us all how to bear our testimonies, and now they probably wish some of us would stop. Speaking of Mormon perversions, do any of you remember the infamous story of Joyce McKinney? Anyone? She was the beauty queen BYU co-ed who flew to England, kidnapped her missionary ex-boyfriend, and chained him spread-eagle to a bed for a wild weekend of sex, food, and fun. Well, she's back and featured in the new Errol Morris documentary, Tabloid, which is now playing in theaters. Errol Morris, you might remember, he won the Academy Award for the Robert McNamara biopic called The Fog of War. And he says that Joyce is a return to his favorite genre, perverse portraiture. Tabloids are truly kitsch journalism, all flash, questionable substance, and spurious ethics, which makes the subject perfect for an Errol Morris film. Back in the 70s, you couldn't open up a British tabloid without seeing the story of Joyce McKinney and the Manacled Mormon. Joyce's intent was, of course, noble. She wanted to save her missionary, Elder Kirk Anderson. She said, quote, "I knew the only way to rescue Kirk from Mormonism was to make love to him," close quote, which I believe led to the very first documented case of LDS&M. Joyce pursued her pear-shaped prince across the globe only to be ultimately arrested for kidnapping. And during her trial before British magistrates, she famously declared, quote, "I love Kirk Anderson so much, I would ski naked down Mount Everest with a carnation up my nose," close quote. Kirk eventually escaped, returned to Orem, and lived a life of obscurity. Joyce went on to clone dogs. I'm not making this up. Joyce is one of the great tragic romantics of our age, more in love with her fantasy than she could possibly ever be with Kirk. She never really recovered from her broken heart. She says that she has chosen to live a life of celibacy, never to know true love, or new love, I should say. I got involved in the film when Errol Morris needed a Mormon to explain theology and missionary culture to his audience. He initially approached active Mormons who were involved firsthand with the scandal, but they either refused or didn't respond. Kirk declined requests to be interviewed, and his mission president, Richard Iyer, declined requests, and his producers thought, as Hollywood producers do, hey, let's get the gay Mormon. He'll do just fine. And I was a huge fan of Errol Morris and a huge fan of Joyce McKinney. I knew her and I admired her. Tenacity. How could I say no? One of the things that I really love about Mormonism is that we always attract eccentric characters. And of course, we've had our share of sociopaths too. Warren Jeffs, Brian David Mitchell, Glenn Beck. They all had that certain something, right? And sadly, these characters, well, not sadly, but they're never going to go away. And that's one thing that I think mainstream Latter-day Saints are going to have to deal with. These creepy characters are going to continue to be featured in satires, parodies, and documentaries because they make such great stories. Now, who here wouldn't tune in and watch a Superdell reality series? I would. Some of you are from out of town. Anyway, please go see Tabloid. It's playing in Salt Lake at the Broadway and in most major cities right now. And gosh, you know, it's been 20 years since I was last a missionary. And it's nice to know that tonight in theaters all around the country, I'm still teaching the gospel. Speaking of spreading the gospel, who here has seen the Book of Mormon musical? Yes? Yes? Awesome. Isn't it awesome?
Yes.
And you know, after I saw it, the first thought that came into my mind was, how on earth did Mormons and gays ever come into so much conflict with each other? Are there two other groups of people that have such a devoted affinity to feel-good musical theater?
No.
And there is this wonderful fusion of energy and joy on the stage. And for those of you who haven't seen it, imagine the spectacle. Mormon culture and theology performed by openly gay actors. If that's not karma, I don't know what it is. And somehow it all works. It's almost as though Mormonism has always belonged on the stage, which isn't a leap for those of us who grew up starring in our own ward and state road shows. We've all relished, or maybe we cringed, during popular dramatizations of Mormonism and church-produced pageants, videos, and commercials. Many Mormons throughout the years have always reduced Mormonism to sentimental kitsch by the art that they've created. Joseph Smith crafted this magnificent cosmology with epic scriptures and theocratic kingdoms and aspirations of apotheosis. And folks took all of that theological brilliance and then wrote Saturday's Warrior. So what do you get when you mix our over-the-top sci-fi cosmology with our Happy Valley brand of Gee Whiz Americana, a Tony Award-winning musical that is sold out until late next year? As a piece of satire, the Book of Mormon musical is many things. It's blasphemous, it's poignant, it's hysterical, it's also full of love. And the non-Mormon satirists from South Park have recognized something profound and beautiful about Mormon culture that they want to offer back to the world. The play believes that Mormons are good people who have a lot to contribute to making the world better. Good satirists see the subjects as they could and should be. Trey Parker and Matt Stone have great affection for us. In their own way, I think that they're even pushing us to accentuate our better selves and to achieve our highest potential, to actually become that good force in the world that they know that we can be. As missionaries, the church trained us to go out and proclaim the gospel and perfect the saints, but the Mormon satirist has another role to play. Satirists are called to offer the gift of redemption to the institutional church. Now, some may resist the idea that a church might need redemption, but as an organization operated by human beings, it is by its very nature full of sort of is subject to faults and foibles. And so Mormon satire, when it's done well, gives the church a chance to see its own quirks and shortcomings, and at times it also offers the church an opportunity to repent. A few years back, I began collaborating with a Salt Lake-based actor named Charles Frost, and we started working on a weekly radio series on KRCL called What Not, What Have You, and Such as That with Sister Dottie S. Dixon. The best of CD, which you can get at the end of my presentation. Now, Dottie was a Mormon housewife from Spanish Fork, Utah, who had a gay son. And of course, Dottie was performed by Charles, who was himself a gay man. The radio series was really a workshop where we practiced the art of satire. The church's involvement in funding Proposition 8 always gave us a lot of fuel to the fire. And the acrimony and division in the community between the church and the gay community was huge. And there was this righteous anger in the air. Because of the church's political actions in 2008, we'll never know completely how many family Thanksgiving dinners were ultimately ruined. When you are experiencing a lot of pain and anger, sometimes it's helpful to try a new approach to conflict. Satire helps us to create a new space, and it offers us a new way to engage each other. So I woke up one morning, I called Charles up, and I said, let's do a live play. Let's take Dottie to the stage with bright lights. And my pitch initially was that she would be a Latter-day Joan of Arc. She'll have a divine mission. And ultimately, after a church trial in court, she'll be burned at the stake somehow. She'll be Joan of Arc, yes, but she'll also be a composite of Sonia Johnson and Lavinia Finley Anderson and Fawn Brody and all the women who've ever been tried by the church. And the show was a huge hit in Salt Lake City. We had 3 sold-out runs. Dottie was voted by the City Weekly Readers as the best Utah of 2010, beating out John Huntsman, which I think may have been the beginning of his campaign turmoil. And the Deseret News, of all people, gave us our most glowing positive reviews. And the audiences were filled each night with, of course, LGBT folks, but there was also all these active Mormons started coming. And we had moms and dads and had bishops and BYU professors all coming together to see a Mormon drag performance. How cool is that? And there are many people who work to bring Dottie to life, but I can only speak for myself. Something profound happened to me while I was writing. As I went back into my memories of growing up Mormon, and I remembered all the primary songs and the state dances and all the times as a kid that I would sit in sacrament meeting and make fun of Sister Lyman's beehive hairdo, I realized that I had forgotten something. I used to deeply love Mormonism. There was so much good that came from being a member of the church as a kid, and I had grown to have so much anger at the church. I felt deep rejection and alienation. The church that had been so nurturing and loving to me as a kid had now become an instrument of my own oppression. But through the process of writing and producing the play, my heart melted a bit, and that made me even more determined. I think good satire is always born out of conflicting emotions. Anger, outrage, sadness, yes, but it also involves love. Love doesn't mean that you back away from cutting critiques. In fact, sometimes out of love, you cut smarter and you cut deeper. And as I wrote the denouement of the play, which took Dottie into her near future, her destiny was to become the first female apostle of the LDS Church, which would soon become an all-open and all-accepting church. She ascends actually to become the prophet at the end of the play, and after she dies, she goes off to the celestial kingdom, which looks just like Spanish Fork, and then leaves the stage to create her own planets, worlds without end. Because that was the Mormonism that I wanted to see. That is the best potential of our faith. Not just to privilege straight white men in the cosmic hereafter, but to honor and lift all people, all races, and all orientations. I think the Book of Mormon musical does the exact same thing. The show ends with transformation. The elders' faith evolves from simplistic, literalist interpretation of sacred stories. Salt Lake City isn't a place, as one wise villager tells another, it's a metaphor. The proud missionaries who initially go out to heal the entire human race actually are humbled and become teachable. They become saved. They learn to reconcile their doubts about the gospel. Elder Price realizes at the end of the show, hey, we're still Latter-day Saints, even if we change a few things. Or even if we have complete doubt that God exists, we can still make this our paradise planet. In a way, the missionaries at the end of the musical become a bunch of Sunstone Mormons. So one last story in closing, bring this all back. One of the hats I've worn around town is the gay activist. And I kind of thrived on more overt confrontational politics. And I spoke at the protests at the temple, and I participated in the kiss-ins when we took over their property. And I've expressed my anger in a lot of creative ways. And finally, one day, the church wanted to meet me. Not the high-ups, mind you, but just the low-level director of the church community relations. And he invited me and a few other gays to be VIP guests to their Christmas concert with David Archuleta. And every gay guy was like, yeah, I'll do that. And that included Dustin Lance Black, who is a gay former Mormon who used to be on the writing staff of Big Love. And before the concert, Lance and I went and met privately with them. And I just want you to picture that for a second. You've got a couple of gay activists and several men in dark suits. Now that was awkward. And can you guess who was there dressed? I could tell that they were a little nervous to meet me, and I was a lot nervous to meet them. But Lance Black is actually much sweeter than I am, and he has this more calming presence, which was really good. But I was able to talk to the church for the first time, and I calmly said, look, you know, I don't criticize you because I want to hurt you. The church made me who I am today. I felt so much love coming from you growing up Mormon. And when we're outside the temple protesting, or if I'm on the radio fuming, am I gone? It was so dramatic, too. Hello, we're back. Oh, battery's dead. That's okay. I had one semester of acting. So I told him, you know, I'm not outside the temple protesting because I want to hurt you or do anything like that. I'm there because I want you to be the best church you can be. And ultimately, I want you to live up to the high values that you taught me as a kid. And it was very emotional. You know, I was kind of teary-eyed, and they were kind of teary-eyed. And they said to me, we're starting to get that. And then one of the church PR guys leaned over and he said, so what are the next steps? And I responded, oh, you've so got to give women the priesthood. So I think what's really important with all of this stuff is we've got to learn to laugh at ourselves. And we can't take ourselves too seriously. And God knows that goes for the people who work in the church office building as well. Mormon parody, satire, Sunstone, the Book of Mormon musical, all of it. Even the seemingly irreverent and profane, they help us to be more human, less earnest, and more open to each other. I think that satire is a necessary gift required for the perfecting of all saints and sinners. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thanks to all of our presenters today. We have a closing hymn with music on the back seat of your paper. While you're pulling that out, I want to remind you to go upstairs tomorrow or on Saturday if you have to work tomorrow. Sorry, folks. The bookstore is upstairs, and we've got, somebody said that Amy's book. Then ask the Inquirer, the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer. They had a couple copies of that. So if you're up to that. And check on Sunstone's website if you're in the Mormon Kids. We did an issue about that a few years ago. It's on the website. You can look it up. Kim is going to lead us, and then is going to say our closing prayer.
I have a loud voice.
Thank you. Grateful for this time that we've had to reflect in humor and amazement and delight on the journey that we're all sharing, that we can learn from each other and can grow less earnest. And we pray that you'll bless the people who shared all this with us, that the joy that they brought them will be joy that they brought to us will be joy to them as well. We pray that we can take this to our various congregations and friends, and that it'll enliven our spirits and bring us closer to each other and to thee, and how thou wouldst have us relate. And we ask these things and give thanks in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.